Talking landscape photography with Kristen Fletcher and Cowan.
That's right. It is another exciting episode of Light-Minded with Cristiano Fletcher and myself, Cowan. Fletch, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you, Cowan? I believe you had a chance encounter with someone famous this week.
Oh, mate, it was the most randomest thing. You know how when you're out shooting, you've got a pro body? It tends to attract people. Have you noticed that?
Are you talking about your personal body or a camera?
No, the camera body. I mean, look, long story short, I was out taking some shots on Saturday morning because I wanted to get some shots of the FPA building in Fremantle. And on the way there, I stopped at the Australia 2 mural on Preston Point Road. Do you know that one?
No, never seen it.
It's a mural of Australia 2. It's, somebody drew it in the 1980s, and it's on the side of a wall on Preston Point Road on the East Fremantle end of Preston Point Road, East Fremantle. So if you're around those sort of parts, go and check it out. Long story short, look, the sun was coming in from behind me, so I thought I'd just grab some shots of that. So I'm shooting away, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw a bloke, you know, just because 9 o'clock Saturday morning, just in a dressing gown and a pair of slippers and his PJs. So we just kind of ignored it. And long story short, this bloke just walks up and starts talking to me. And, you know, it was a little bit awkward. And, you know, what are you doing? And I was like, oh, you know, I'm just, you know, photographing this for a personal art project. And we chatted about, you know, some of the graffiti that was on it. And I tried to wipe it off and that sort of stuff unsuccessfully. And I sort of, I dared to make eye contact because it was a little bit awkward. And it was Kev Templey from Eskimo Joe.
Nice.
Oh, mate, he obviously lives around those parts somewhere, but
well, I hope he lives close because if he's walking around in his pajamas around East Fremantle, that's probably not a good thing.
Well, you'd like to think so, but it was quite ironic, really, because I've spent quite a few years in broadcasting, in radio, and I have tried to reach out to Cav so many times about coming onto one of my radio shows and just doing, you know, recording a couple of tags for me and that sort of stuff. Never been able to get him. He's always too famous. And then randomly I'm standing there on Saturday morning chatting to him in his dressing gown and pajamas.
Yeah. It's funny how life works. Anyway, speaking of legends, on the line all the way from his studio in Melbourne, we have got Les Walkling. Les, how are you this morning?
Good, Christian. And how are you?
Fantastic, mate. Fantastic. It's a sunny day here. It's warming up. It's getting probably be about 13 degrees at the moment. I've got a coffee and I'm talking to one of my good mates. So what have you been up to?
Well, I haven't left the property since early March. Oh. But we've got 3/4 of an acre here in Heidelberg, and yep, plenty of garden to play in. But of course, straight away we went. We moved everything completely, holeless bolus, all consultations, all you know, board meetings, all teaching online. So we've got a 7-camera TV studio now in one corner of our studio, and that's where I'm sitting right at the moment, although the cameras aren't working, obviously.
Yeah. So you haven't actually, I mean, obviously you've gone out to get shopping and all that sort of stuff, but you haven't gone anywhere?
No, absolutely not. I'm in a really high-risk category, you know, several comorbidities, so why would I gamble when Woolworths were amazing? I mean, straight away, you know, if you had a diabetes, Australia card or anything like that, they organised priority deliveries, and 85% of what I needed to get, I could kind of get from Woolworths, and the other 15%, who cares, you know? So no, it's not an issue at all. Oh, the only time I ventured out, to be honest, is 3 monthly blood tests at my local GP. So and that's 200 meters away. So
Really?
Playing it safe, Fletch. Yeah, I've got a lot of things I want to do. I don't want to die anytime soon.
We don't want you to die any time.
Well, it's going to happen, Fletch. I'm sorry, mate.
But
not anytime soon.
Yeah, but who cares? I mean, I wasn't alive for, you know, what is it, 40 billion years? So, I mean, what is it going to matter for another 40 billion years? But I've just got a couple of things I'd like to do before that happens.
Yeah. I know. I mean, I have talked to you in the past about, you know, when are you going to do a concise book of everything that you know
I'm sorry, that wouldn't be too concise, Fletcher. I do a lot of things, mate. But anyway, no, who cares? It's there's all sorts of things that we need to do. Yep.
Yeah. So how was the transition then to, you know, creating this studio? was that a lot of learning to a lot of a
big... No, not really. I mean, to be honest, it's a bit embarrassing, but in 1998, I co-pioneered distance learning into RMIT when a mob in Kuala Lumpur wanted to buy my media arts program. I couldn't even do video in those days, of course. Yeah. And I looked it up the other day. Since 2011, we've been consulting virtually around the world. So, but we needed a really mature NBN and stable NBN, which we've only really had here in Heidelberg since December last year. Yeah. And but all the capture cards, you know, you know, we had all of this stuff. Andre with all of his insane 3D photogrammetry and virtual worlds, and we've you know, we've got 50 DSLRs you know, running Magic Lantern on the Canons, you know, all set up and ready to go. The only thing I had to buy really was just a couple of little preview monitors to stick on top of a couple of the cameras when I'm remote, just so I can see what I'm presenting.
Well, I have to say what you've done is amazing, because we had our little chat for our canceled Daintree workshop, which was a real bummer, because we would have just finished that workshop now. So Les and I were going to do a workshop in the Daintree, and it was all set up, but of course COVID came along and ruined that. But we got Les organised a get together with all the people, and I had come in late because I had another Zoom call with Eastway and Hewitt, and but it was so amazing to see, and I actually liked it as much as being in the room with you, because you were talking directly to me, you know. I was looking at you on my screen, and you know, of course I just get lost in your words anyway, Les. Whenever you start talking, I just you know, I just focus, you know. It's sort of like meditation. You should put out a meditation tape. It would work well.
Good heavens. Yeah. Maybe not.
Well, maybe not first thing in the morning, because I remember our last conversation, you mentioned that you're a Scorpio, and when you get out of bed in the morning, you know, you get out, you're ready to fight, you know, so maybe late in the afternoon. Yeah. But so how have you set up your studio? You've got obviously multiple cameras, because did you say you had seven different camera angles?
Well, yeah, we've worked out that about seven cameras works. Like, I've got my super high res overhead where you put books down and open them up and draw things and print out, say, the script for the workshop and then write all over it with my fountain pen annotating it. Mm. I've got just a crap webcam in the MacBook, which is only really just for the little thumbnail in Zoom conferencing. Just over to the left, I've got an f1.2 L-series 50mm Canon lens running at f1.2 on a full-frame 5D, and that's my sort of soft and dreamy, you know, when I've got to get more personal and poetic. And
yes, I like that one.
You saw that one, didn't you? Yeah, and I've EQ'd, I've tweaked it, you know, the color balance and everything, so that it's just a little warmer than the other cameras. You know, it's a little more reminiscent, and so. And then I've got on a gimbal, I've got a super high res camera, which is wide angle and, you know, great depth of field with a small sensor, and that's on a gimbal. But that's also, you probably would have seen me cut to that when I had to have a real heart to heart and, you know, deal with the facts of the matter, you know, the great depth of field and the super sharp and the slight distortion as I lean into it and so forth. This is how you put exclamation points into the proceedings. Then I've got wide field showing one part of the studio so you can see the setup and the printers. Then we have another camera in the back, which is on a tripod, but is also high res, which I move around a great deal. That's not apart from the super high res to my left on the gimbal. All the others are tethered now through cables. And then I've got another permanent one set up on the gantry in the back of the studio, looking down. This is for the print workshops, and primarily looking down at our large, you know, exhibition space, gallery wall, where I can zoom in remotely and whatnot in good high res as we're comparing prints on the wall, before and afters and things like that. So we move these around and we can reconfigure them in different ways with different lighting scenarios. So I guess there's 1, 2, 3, 4. We've got 5 sort of environments that these cameras, including where I'm sitting now in front of the main, you know, workstation. But anyway, look, it's really good fun. But thanks to Andre, we had all this gear, apart from 2 little, you know, 7-inch preview monitors, the only things that were missing.
Yeah. Dr. Walkling, in your opinion, is this the way the world's going now, where we are going to have setups like this in our studios?
Well, that's what everyone's telling us, and I can't disagree. To be perfectly honest, given the transformation of this main area where I am now, that's our large table where people would sit around during the studio workshops here. So, you know, I josh when on Zoom, I go, oh, you know, Fletch, you're sitting over there to my right, you know, where that camera is, and I cut to that camera. So I try and make it as real as possible in terms of, you know, destroying that COVID process that is a different sense of time and space, trying to destroy that. But I would have to disassemble this whole setup here in order to have people around the table again. Yeah. So I'm not going to do that anytime soon. Probably never, to be honest.
Wow, really?
I mean, therefore, the face-to-face will just be the master classes at RMIT for the postgraduate students. Mm-hmm. Will be like our Daintree workshop, you know, Fletch, my annual North Queensland residential workshop. God, I missed you this year. It was so wonderful to see you on Sunday because
thanks, Liz.
I hadn't realised I'd actually been pining to spend 10 days with you, you know, and each day without actually saying it out loud because I'd get too upset. I was actually pining to hang out. Yeah. So I saw you pop on Sunday, you know, after your battle, you know, with Eastway, I teared up. It was just wonderful, mate.
Well, actually, I have to say, Les, my wife was tearing up because she wanted to get rid of me for 10 days. So so she kind of felt the same.
Wow. Yeah. Well, there you go. What goes around comes around. But Fletch, I mean, I now have to worry about time zones. Like, I can't have people attending a workshop from New Zealand and where you are in WA simultaneously. You know, I can do East Coast, West Coast. I can do East Coast, Australia, New Zealand. Yeah, I can do Indonesia, East Coast, and so forth. But I was working with some people in Pakistan just the other day, and I had to start at 3 p.m. our time. Yeah. You know, and things like that. I did a whole presentation in the States a little while ago. I think I started at 12:30 a.m. and went through to 8 a.m. our time. Presented a live virtual workshop over there. So, you know, it's just – but that is just extraordinary.
It's exciting actually when you talk about it because, like, you know, you can do your workshops there where you are, but you pretty much, you know, people aren't going to travel all over the world to get to you for a 1 day, half day workshop, whatever.
I know.
But you've got access now to anyone in the world, anywhere, anytime, and you can present as well as you can if they were there in front of you. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Look, from one of the very for the first month, you know, for the month of March, you know, I had lots of people. All the workshops were full. Lots of people enrolled, and of course, you know, we couldn't do the face to face. So I just used that opportunity to do 27 almost on a daily basis. Like half-day seminars, just to test different environments, different cameras. You know, that didn't bloody well work. We'd reconfigure something, and oh, crikey, Andre, we need that switching desk. You know, until we settled on this sort of arrangement that I tried to describe earlier. But the first real, you know, 7-hour workshop that I did, a lovely friend from up north, up at Airlie Beach, she attended. And, you know, she said in the feedback, she said, you know, that saved me $1,300 in airfares and accommodation and being away from my family. And she's come down probably at least 3 times in the past to do different workshops. And she said, and I felt like I was sitting closer to the action than if I'd even been there in person with only you know, 4 others around the table. And I thought, wow, that blew my mind.
Yeah. Hey, have you, speaking of all this stuff, I was reading a little bit recently about 6G. You know, we're all talking about 5G and all that, and I'm not sure what your thoughts are on 5G, whether it caused coronavirus or whether it's whatever, you know, all those theories. But 6G sounds amazing because they're saying that the speed of 6G is so great that it's going to unleash all these technologies. So all this hologram stuff, you know, all these things that you see on the movies, it's what's going to happen. I have to go back and read the article. It's a big article. It's a big PDF from, I think it was from HP, I think, or one of those companies. And I can just imagine when that happens and everyone's using that, we will have you in our space. You'll come up as a hologram, or your environment will be there. And they're talking about this mixed reality as well, so the mix of AR and VR, and that's all capable, that's all possible because of this, you know, these transfer speeds and all this whatever.
Yeah. Is this legit?
And I thought, wow, how good would that be to have you as a three-dimensional hologram talking in to us in our lounge rooms or whatever? You know, that would be really cool.
Absolutely. Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. Anyway, yeah. Look, I'm thoroughly enjoying it, and I don't have to clean the studio meticulously before people arrive every Sunday, so that helps.
Actually, I need to do the same thing. I would do workshops at my gallery, and I would take – it was just like a night thing, and I would take all our dining chairs down there. And this would happen a couple of times a month. And every time I went down, I spent the whole afternoon cleaning the bloody chairs because my kids were little at that stage and they were just dropping food everywhere. So these things would just get full of food and covered in grease and grime. Yeah, so, yeah, I agree. Having to clean before everyone arrives is pretty sucky.
Well, it's just the cameras, the locked-off cameras, you know, have a fixed angle of view. So as long as that's neat and tidy, I don't know. The rest of the studio can. Well, but it's amazing because it means I don't have all that time that I have to pack up what I'm doing and then unpack it. You know, all the books stay out and all the prints are there. And, you know, it's and I haven't had that in over 20-plus years. So that is lovely. And you know, I can still help people. Yep.
Liz, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
You're a scholar of the world, and we asked Tony this at the start of this pandemic. You know, where's this going? Did you in your life ever imagine this type of scenario? And also, where is this going?
Well, I mean, we've had pandemics. Forever, one of the first things my GP gave me was a book on a plague that lasted 300 years in Europe. You know, and we've had this stuff forever. And you can see how extraordinarily well prepared some of our Asian neighbours have been because they went through, you know, SARS and MERS, and they had a whole hospitals and things just set up ready to go. And they understood the protocols. So, I mean, it's part of life, isn't it? These horrible things. I grew up when polio, we still had to distance because of polio and horrendous things like that. So, I'm not a doomsday prophet by any means, but I've always, tried not to take things for granted, we've had financial collapse after collapse after collapse, even in my lifetime. Crikey, the first studio we ever bought, I think I was paying 17.9% interest,
I remember that.
Frightening stuff. So, you know, you cut the cloth to fit, and we've always, you know, just tried to live accordingly, I guess. But but it's you know, the deaths and the suffering and all the stuff that's coming out about long-term problems that people are inheriting from this horrendous terrible virus. It's just so sad.
Yeah. But do you reckon this is the new normal? Some people are describing it, you know, some people are saying this is the reality from now on.
Well, I think it's just pushed us a little bit faster to that point. I mean, I think this is what we've already been. I mean, as I said, we've been doing some form of distance learning at RMIT since 1998. And as the technology enables, you know, Fletch, you know, talking about 6G, as the technology enables all of these things, then it's just inevitable. I mean, look at, you know, can you even imagine a time before social media? You really have to try hard. So, I mean, I don't think new normal, it's just accelerated. I think this is where we've been heading for a long, long time. The beauty, though, if we can get on top of this virus, the beauty, though, is the increased flexibility and options that it provides.
Yeah.
Isn't that the whole promise of this technologically mediated reality we now, you know, walk through? This ability to twist and turn and do things in time and space.
Yeah.
In ways that have been very difficult. I mean, we're not working at the speed of a dripping tap any longer in a dark room unless we choose that mode of operation. Yeah. So it's just the possibilities, this convergence of technology is just marvelous.
Yeah. Yep. Hey, look, there's a quote that you've got on your website, which I really like. It says, there is no need for the Western political artist, too often a disaster tourist, to sail the seven seas looking for injustices to denounce. Inequality and exploitation saturate the ground on which we stand. They are in the grain of everyday life. And I thought that was such a great quote and really relevant to what's happening. I mean, my daughter has become a little activist, and I just read that and thought, wow, this is so relevant to what's going on. Why have you got that on your website, Les?
That's a Victor Bergen quote. Hmm. He's someone that I've always just admired beyond belief. Not just as an artist, but of course as a theoretician, as an academic, extraordinary man. Hmm. And as part of that vanguard in the 1970s that sort of helped us turn so much on its head in the world of art and culture. And you've got to realize the context that's set in, right? Mm. This foraging the world as a disaster tourist. I mean, this is interesting stuff.
Mm.
That because, and I'm talking primarily about photography here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there is such a tendency in photography, in certain areas of photography, I don't know, what do you call them, these hero shots or these trophy shots? I mean, this extraordinary vista that is so photogenic, it's just gobsmackingly unbelievable almost, but you're standing there in front of it. But this idea of just going and pillaging the world and taking pictures rapistly of the world, almost like we used to kill animals and put their heads on walls. I mean, some people still do, I guess. Mm. That, and I see that's a real problem. A small p problem, but I think that creates a difficulty in terms of that confusion of how we think about photography from an activist point of view, from photography being in the vanguard of helping us understand and bring about change in this world, as it has so often been configured in different regimes of the past. Yeah. So that's, I mean, there's a bigger story around that, but that's kind of at the heart of it, I think, Fletch, if that helps at all.
I thought it was just a great quote, and it's really good to read. The hardest thing for me, I think, to achieve in photography is to create work that has something more than just a pretty aesthetic. Mm. So, what can we do to get our head into a space to photograph more thoughtfully? Is there something that we should think? I mean, I just struggle with this stuff all the time. I go, what am I going to photograph next? And why am I going to photograph it? What can we do to get into the right headspace, do you reckon?
That Victor Bergen quote kind of tackles that, doesn't it? Because he's critiquing, people who posit themselves as artists of meaning, producers of meaning, political meaning in particular, but who then enact that colonized rumination, rummaging almost around the world, looking for disasters. He says something like sailing the seven seas, looking for things to denounce, looking for inequalities or exploitation or denigration and it, without turning around and looking in your own backyard, this whole colonized diaspora, this expansionist way that Western civilization has operated, going into places that are not our own and taking it over. Now, at the heart of that is this idea that making works of art can be about many things, but one of those things a work of art can be about is a contestation of meaning, you know, which could be how we understand images or how we reason about images or how we use images. Now, then I think you've got to ask yourself the question about your question and who wants to know and why do you want to know? Mm. You know, so what is it that motivates you to ask such a question, yeah, about meaning and about how do you go about doing this? And does it come from within because you feel you're scratching away at things, but you're not just there yet? So how do I actually get that into my vocal cords, and how do I articulate what I've been doing, yes, in another way, you know, another way that enables what I've been doing, taking beautiful pictures, for example, to be inserted on behalf of, you know, inserted into another process.
Yeah.
So that's one part of it. Or is it an external calling? Is it, you know, you want to hang out with these people? Yeah. And they hang out over there and they listen to this radio and they, you know, they do these things. Therefore, I'm going to put the same uniform on and become part of the club, part of the team. Yeah. How do I do that? You know, where do I get access to that uniform? Yeah, which can be, yes, a metaphor for all manner of attributes. Yeah. Or is it kind of a value judgment on yourself that I'm not quite sure about what I'm doing? I know I'm good at it, but, you know, and that somehow the grass is greener on the other side of the fence and maybe I want to be seen like that. So these are really complex questions, personal questions, but also cultural questions, you know, about one's embeddedness within the society we find ourselves in and the culture that grows out of that association. What am I seeking? How am I seeking to be a contributor to such discussion? Does that?
Yeah.
It doesn't answer your question, but in terms of trying to put it into a working context.
Well, that asks some good questions of me and what I'm looking for, because I don't know what I'm, you know, sometimes I just feel like, yeah, look, I can, in my sleep, I can get up and take a beautiful photograph that looks pretty and you can hang it on your wall. But I'm always searching for something a little bit deeper than that. I don't know why whether it's, maybe it's an ego thing. Maybe I think, you know, I would love to be a Bill Henson, maybe, or, you know, and maybe there's that thought that, you know, you see what he does and why do I want to be like that? I don't know. I mean, I just often kind of get up and go, I get in the car, I put the camera in the car and I head off looking for something. And often I just find myself photographing stuff I've always photographed. I don't know. Maybe it's ideas I'm looking for. So that's the...
Yeah, well, okay, we've got two brains, haven't we? Mm. And we've got two brains for good reason. Sometimes just out of our sheer birthright, you know, we seem to be more predisposed to one side of our head than the other, you know. You know, Andre was very good at maths, so, you know, straight away he could reason and understand things on that level, but he had another calling that was far more poetic. Yeah. And the things that tugged at his heartstrings, you know, Andre's my son, of course, that tugged at his heartstrings in the later years of high school rose to the point that it just forced him to jump ship.
Yeah.
And even though he could be a physicist or whatever now, you know, he chose the world of art because of its prioritizing of things that can't be seen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And those emotional connections, those intellectual forays into thinking and the world at large, understanding the world and ourselves at large, that's what captured his being. Yeah, so capable of many things, but at that liminal point. Now, the other problem, though, is that once you've made that choice. You made that choice a long time ago, Fletch, that for the world of photography, of pictures, of images, of working in the world around you visually was going to be, that's where you belong. Yeah. But the problem is that when we keep doing the same thing over and over again, it can get really stale. Now, you see this in musicians, who maybe, and I'm using musicians, some of my musical friends as an example here, because they tend to mature so early compared to visual artists. They these prodigies. Christ, I mean, my friend Virgil Donati, the earliest vision we have of him on stage at the Catani Ballroom in High Street, Thornbury, playing with his father's swing band. The dude wasn't even 3 years of age. ching, chinka, ching, ching. I mean, prodigy, a Mozart, unbelievable. Yeah. Now, the difference is, how do you then live your life in the service of that gift? Yeah, and in the service of sharing that and the hope that it will make some difference to someone else, as the Mozarts have made a difference to yourself. Now, someone like Virgil is extraordinary. At the height, redefining his instrument, the drum kit, like over and over again, and doing things that are, you see all these analyses online of these very gifted musicians who transcribe a solo of his or a piece of orchestration of his, and they write it and they write it out and they understand what's going on. And these are incredibly gifted musicians, but they can't play it themselves. And they go, if anyone can pull this off, please send us a video. They can. So there's the doing, but there's also the conceptualization. Now, I know with someone like Virgil, I mean, he's one of the closest people in the world I've got to that I would call a brother, right? Yeah. Dear Virgil, he's what has kept him going, though, is a similar drive to what you're articulating. I can always do better. I can always do something more. I can, if only. And always having this. Now, some people would call it insecurity, but when it's a mature process, it actually is functional. It actually enables you. You use that doubt or that uncertainty to motivate. Now, one of the great parts of my friendship with Virgil over all of these years, right? And I produced and directed all of his early videos, all of the stuff, writing liner notes for him still for some of his album releases. All of the stuff we've done, he's come to me to talk, because I can't play the drums to save myself, but I love the instrument, right? He hasn't come to me about drumming. He's come to me about his thinking about drumming, and I've gone to him as to how he actually works as an artist. So we're using bits of each other, that are superior in each other, to come together to help each other, climb this next rung of the ladder, whatever that happens to be. Now, for Virgil, even though it's music, from my heart to thy heart, as Beethoven, once said, it's the most abstract in one sense, and the most immediate of all the arts, because it's just there and it swamps. And you're talking about Bill. Well, the way he has his huge speaker stack set up in his gargantuan studio, you are actually, when you're sitting at his workstation, you are actually in the middle of the orchestra pit. You're not in the audience. It's unbelievable. Right? totally cool. So you're talking about the ideas, but also as a means, I reckon, of then motivating you to, we just tell the same story our whole life, Fletch. So we're just going to keep photographing the same things because they're the things we understand that we're drawn to and that we love and admire. Yeah. So it's about photographing them because you love and admire them. So you're not going to not want to keep photographing such things, but in a new way. In a way that motivates us to then consider what we're doing in a new light. Mm. Now, how many wonderful letters have I got from people during the lockdown saying, it's given me a chance to go back through my archive. I can't believe the images I'm finding. So through this COVID process, that we're going through, this lens that COVID, time and space, has conferred on our understanding of the world, our place in it, and who we are. Through this new lens, sadly forced upon these friends of mine, that gave them this ability to look back at their own endeavors and discover things that they hadn't even realized they had done. Yeah. So how do you do this then? How do you – well, yes, you can like, I won't mention names, but when we were very, very young, a dear, dear friend of mine who's had an illustrious career in film and television staged a horrendous breakup with his wife and everything because he just felt that his only way he was going to get over his writer's block. He needed to be thrown off the pier, you know, and try. I mean, it's pathetic, but, you know, we were 20 years of age or something, you know, in stupid. So, I mean, but that idea that often, for all sorts of reasons, it's the worst moments of our lives that cause us to be unstable long enough to have another go at who we are and what we're doing.
Why is that, Les? Because you talk to some comedians, for example, and most are chronically depressed. Not there's anything wrong with that. But that seems to be a place where their best work comes from, is some sort of you know, I guess, instability.
Well, comedy is the last bastion of democracy as far as I'm concerned. It's, you know, you can get up at a pub and just scream at the top of your lungs about all manner of things. And the really smart ones out there, you know, the really smart ones, you know, the Jim Jefferies and so on, you know, they just cut to the core, you know, just so brilliantly that Talking Funny, I don't know if you've seen that 60-minute documentary hosted by Ricky Gervais, Talking Funny, you know, where he's got Seinfeld and, you know, Louis and, yeah, it's just a masterclass on how you make art, and they're just telling each other's jokes, and it's just unbelievable. Now, so, yeah, I mean, comedians, I think, like Andre and I go to, you know, comedians all the time. You know, because whether it's Seth Meyers, you know, on mainstream cable TV or what have you, because they have a license and it's built into their remit. It's built into their remit to have a go at things. Yeah. And the smartest of them, you know, the George Carlins and so on, just cut to the quick and they're just brilliant. Yeah. Now, but that doesn't mean you're a happy person just because you can do such things. I mean, most people I know are not terribly happy and haven't been for a very long time, if ever. That doesn't mean you take your life, you know. And one of the great things is, you know, when one finds oneself, you know, battling with all manner of things, you know, physical and mental and so social and so forth, that's an intellectual challenge if you take it in the right way. It doesn't mean you're still not going to be denigrated and oppressed and denied and hurt and subjugated and all of the other evils. But look at the great human rights, you know, activists, at least even from my lifetime. You know, not the Trumps of the world, obviously, but, you know, the great human rights activists all across this planet, and especially in such war-torn places like the United States of America at the moment. These are extraordinary people taking extraordinary – and with extraordinary gifts and the ability to share them. So it's no different for us. It's just that we might not broadcast like they do, you know, on cable television. Our broadcasting might be to our family or a small group of friends or our camera club or, you know, but they're all just degrees of the same thing, different degrees of scale. So this idea another way I'd like to say it. You know, in the world of art, a lot of the labor that goes on, a lot of the work in, say, art photography, it's intellectual labor, it's conceptual work, right? So we've got to, as we deal with the complexities of the technology, you know, f-stop, shutter speeds, diffraction, and so forth, we've also, there is this possibility that we can also deal with the intellectual labor, that side of it. And that with my friends and, you know, the Bill Hensons and, you know, Virgil and that is what helps them, yes, prioritize and feed that side of their equation. Now, if Virgil didn't learn a single new thing for the rest of his days, he would still be one of the greatest, if not the greatest, drummer that has ever existed, right?
Yes.
But it's this intellectual quest about how can I, he has complete independence of all four limbs and they can be playing in different time signatures at the same time. And it sounds fucking amazing, right? Okay. Like it's a work of art. It's not just the show off kind of, F-stops and shutter speed stuff. Now, the problem is, though, Fletch, and this is the thing that we've all got to be careful of, because we're visual artists first and foremost. We don't, as we used to say at art school, you don't want to be a second-rate philosopher. You don't want to. It's so easy to fall into this trap of walking around the world just sprouting drivel, yeah, and thinking that it means something, and trying to big note yourself because, oh, look, I've got an idea. I'm not just a photographer. I mean, that is just such a bastardization of this process we're talking about. So how do you feed yourself? What does it actually mean to work conceptually? Now look, I've got a lot of mates who are commercial photographers. Yeah, they work commercially, or they used to before COVID. That they certainly plan and stage and perform their photographs. Absolutely, yes. But that doesn't mean they are being made as works of art, you see. So there's a real interesting little distinction there. What does it mean being made as a work of art? I'm making this photograph consciously as a work of art. Now, the people, and it's really interesting, those questions tend to be asked by people outside of the world of art. Mm. You know, inside any bubble, the assumptions are just taken for granted, and you just listen to that music, you just look at those films, you just do it because it's where you find yourself belonging.
Yeah.
But it's interesting in retrospect to step aside for just a second and go, well, hang on, what is the primary job I'm doing? Mm. Now, what is it? What am I spending most of my time doing? Is that also what other artists that I admire are doing? And is that what they are also interested in? Now, when you start thinking like that, straight away you are, it's like steering a ship, isn't it? You are aligning yourself towards a certain, destination. Mm. And to the extent that what interests you is thinking about thinking, then you've just got to be careful not to confuse that with anything else than you just being interested with thinking about thinking. Mm. And therefore you're heading towards hanging out with people in words and in videos, eventually in person again, I hope. Talking to dead people, as I like to say all the time. That you're heading, you're steering, you're prioritizing your time and your interests towards things that have more to do with thinking about thinking rather than images about images. But then at times you get into real trouble. Why the hell is this bloody, oh my God, I've got focus shift in this lens. Are you serious? Oh my. So then suddenly the intellectual pursuit goes to service the technical rather than the emotional or the philosophical or the ethical, right? Right. Yeah. But all the time, you see, it's a history of ideas that you're circulating within. But what is my primary job? Maybe is a way that some of us help focus our time, our energy, our concerns. I always say, it's who you keep company with that is more important than anything else. You hang out with silly people too much and you become silly yourself, which is fine if you want to be silly, but not so good if you want to be something other than that, right? So, it's not about just having an idea, right? And there's no ultimate idea, because ideas are being valued more or less all the time. I mean, we now have extraordinary acceleration of this, though.
Yeah.
See, this is what the COVID process, as I call it, is bringing to the table. This radical change in how we relate to time and space, you know, these coordinates of our everyday common sense, right? It's extraordinary how this is enabling these other things to happen. Now, of course, horrendous deaths of people of color in places like the supposed land of the free is just, you know, beyond the pale. But that has enabled, with all these other frustrations and injustices, for yet another race riot, another conflagration. And this is when things really change. The very last conversation I had with my father all those years ago was when the student-led riots in May 1968 were burning the streets of Paris.
Yeah.
And I remember him, you know, he's a very intellectual man. You know, we had a wonderful kind of, he was helping me as a young boy trying to understand what this was about and the meanings and things that were being contested and that people felt were worth putting their lives almost on the line for, certainly to desecrate public space in the name of trying to bring about an awareness, let alone change. So we're going through another extraordinary moment of such conflagration. And yet, and you know, it's here in Australia as well. But of course, you know, we're probably worse than anyone else on the planet in terms of our denigration of our own Indigenous people. So yeah, you know, we've got a lot we've got to do and a lot we've got to learn. But you see, because the zeitgeist, the compass has moved, yeah, the spirit of our time has moved, things now are deemed to be more able or acceptable, and therefore the possibility of change is huge. Now, just being interested in the spirit of your time, you know, just what is happening around you. And this is where the comedians are unbelievable, because they can respond instantly, you know, and their incredible intellects just enable them to deliver this stuff in such motivating and not just entertaining ways. Now, so just ideas on their own is not what it's about. It's about an engagement with the things around you. And as long as you don't let that left brain of yours get the better of you, right, and be, try and end up becoming a second-rate philosopher or third-rate philosopher, right, if you just use it as that lens, that filter, this is how I think I've always done it. You just, yeah, you see the world through these priorities that you've set yourself, and you, and I mean, you quoted Victor Bergen. Oh my God. I mean, that was from, what was that? Oh, that's right. It was from an essay that he wrote about 10 years ago, but I think it was 1980, he published a book called Thinking Photography. He was a young man back then.
Yeah.
Like we all were. I think it was 1982 or something like that, and called Thinking Photography. And this was one of those, and this had come on the end of, you know, decades of various other, you know, cultural theorists talking about photography in interesting, incredibly interesting ways.
Yeah.
And but this was a watershed, and there's all manner of stuff exploding around this time. This is the beginning of postmodernism, of course, you know, the denouncing of canons of, you know, thou shalt's in these worlds of ours, and the understanding of relativity in a cultural sense. You know, people like Frank Webster would be talking about responsibility in visual communication, and they would talk about it as the new photography. And then people started to apply what in a university setting is called critical theory, trying to apply these methodologies to analyzing and understanding, you know, once again, the understanding images or reasoning, thinking about images or how images are used to represent this or that. And people like William Mitchell. My God, that must have been like 1992, the Reconfigured Eye, talking about visual truth in a post-photographic era, 1991-92. Extraordinary, and you know, he's talking about digital imaging and the whole, you know, what's authentic and what's fake and all of these extraordinary things. Now, these are all conceptual ideas, and photography is at the center of all of this stuff. Yeah. But you see, it's not primarily about taking pictures or genres of photography, or it's about these other things, of which photography is just, you know, an element of it, you know, and the reason for looking at such things. So Bergen is right up there. Now, this is very intellectual stuff. I mean, you pick up something like Thinking Photography, even though it's, you know, more than half a lifetime ago now. And you you know, there are some incredible images in there. I mean, of course, it's not a picture book. And so any images in it are badly reproduced. And, yeah, there's, you know, 50,000 words for every picture. But it's like... there are chapters like, there are essays like The Critique of the Image, On the Invention of Photographic Meaning, that was Sekula, Looking at Photographs, there were topics that were brought together that really shattered that illusion, that glass wall that had grown up around photography, that was so dominated by only certain uses of photography or certain ways of thinking. If you go to the reference section in a library and you look at all the old encyclopedias and, you know, and so forth, and you look at how photography in a very, very mainstream conservative environment was without any questioning of that environment or, you know, why those values were deemed to be more valuable, that's how it was presented. And so these people, you know, the Victor Bergens of the world, were just attacking that whole idea of what photography is or can be. Now, of course, that doesn't stop you taking pictures. I mean, there's an incredibly beautiful Walker Evans picture in Thinking Photography, Leslie Friedlander, Rodchenko, you know, some of the greatest practitioners in the history of modernism and the avant-garde are in that book, but they're not in there as heroic artists. They're in there for these other. I mean, a contemporary, much younger chap who's just extraordinary, Jeff Dyer. You know, The Ongoing Moment and books like that continue that sort of reinvestigation through the canon of the history of photography and reconsider it from all different angles. And then it goes from there to you know, incredibly enlightening and extreme deconstructions of all manner of processes. Just like, you know, if you look at in Black Lives That Matter now, the whole problem of a lot of the way the feminist movement has been seen to represent women of color, you know, within their debates and their struggles, and you know, there's now a whole conflagration has been erupting for several decades, I guess, around such things. So it's this constant revision and re-engagement. And like science, at its best, it's a self-leveling process, you know, where it's peer-reviewed and people agree and disagree, and it's not just politics. You know, it's not just I like or fuck off, you know, and, you know, or I'll punch you in the face. You know, it's this engagement with things that you find yourself interested in that others, because we're human, are interested in. And that's what you use to then as your lens through which to see the things that you love, through our lenses that we draw the world with. Sorry. Yeah.
No, you're right. Look, sorry for cutting you off, but I want to ask you, as obviously somebody that is a very deep thinker, this Black Lives Matter, are we seeing a revolution in our lifetimes?
Well, to say it's a revolution means there's an agreed sort of status quo that needs to be overthrown. Yeah. But don't forget, you know, I mean, you can go back to the early days of settlement in Victoria, and the Aboriginal people who stood up and tried, yes, to say there's another way that we could be doing such things. It's this has always been going on. Now, the whole problem with saying it's a revolution is that it compartmentalizes it as something other, something else. Yes. Oh, you're the opposition. Let's send in the police and beat them up because, you know, they're revolutionaries, they're anarchists, they're whatnot. Mm-hmm. Now, sadly, this is the simplistic mechanism, it seems, that through which culture at that broad level operates. And so, yeah, I think it's kind of, you know, it's about change. And if revolutionary aspects are required, you know, marching in the streets and you know, getting down on one's knee and, you know, from the tokenistic to the most powerful, putting your life on the line, yes, for such things, then that's what it takes. But culture, and I think, hasn't COVID really helped us understand this more profoundly than our day-to-day common sense would have it? You know, the advertisers won the battle a long time ago for our consciousness, and the Facebooks and everyone just make it even worse. I mean, there seemed to be a real issue there. Now, instead of just thinking, oh, yeah, this is how the world is, and yeah, it's okay, I can take all my personal details and all of this. No, this is about us reformulating and asking questions about our relationship, you know, to reality and to all of the things that we find ourselves taking for granted.
But can I just on that relationship to reality, just back to that Black Lives Matter rally in Perth, which was when was that? Fletch, about 5-6 weeks
ago? Yeah. My wife and daughter went up for that with some friends. So
this will be interesting to get your feedback on this too, Christian, because I went to that as well. And that was, you know, just slightly post-COVID-19 here in WA, Dr. Walkley. So it was, you know, it was risky stuff. So people were headed down to Langley Park, which is our main park in the heart of Perth, and they were taking a risk. And, you know, it was chockers. Like I went down there and I took a couple of photos, and I remember catching up with some people that afternoon saying there were like 20 or 30,000 people there. Langley Park was completely chockers. And then it was reported in mainstream media that there was 5 or 6,000.
What did
Jen say? Like, how many people did she say were down there, Fletch?
Yeah, well, she said the same, that it was a really great turnout, and she was worried about the march, you know, marching through the street because everyone was so packed in close together. But she said at the same breath, she was so glad that they did that because it was so powerful, you know, to have that many people all chanting the same thing and, you know, solidarity sort of walking there. It was the highlight of the whole thing for her, you know, whole rally.
But there was a lot more than, what did they officially say, 6 or 8,000 people.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never seen, you know, and I remember leaving and there were people just streaming into Langley Park. Like I've got photography, you know, and that's what you were saying. It's like, you know, the reality that we're given, is that actually a reality?
Yeah, but it's just crazy to think that culture is not at war. I mean, it always is. Contestation is the name of our species and our game. So we, you know, advertising, you know, blah, 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 consumerism, all this, these can be methods of lulling one into a sense of, you know, complacency or everything's fine, or, you know, I'm happy, my team won, and, you know, all of these things. Yeah. But that's an incredibly privileged position from those people who are in a position to be able to have such complacency. I mean, so many people simply aren't in such a position. I mean, the show I helped my dear friend Paul Dunn do just recently was an incredible eye-opener for me because, I mean, he works in disability and he's a great artist who's in Melbourne now and, you know, these huge survey shows, but he's always worked, his whole life has been devoted to working in disability services. Yeah. And, I mean, this whole thing about how people living with a disability, how difficult it is for them to rent and do these things. So we had, you know, this wonderful sort of, there's films about it. There's all manner of things, a huge movement. And I played a very small role helping Paul with his photographic exhibition, these extraordinary portraits of people, you know, in their homes, you know, living with a disability. They're just the most – anyway, the point is that, you know, from a point of view that is not my own, the way the world is can be so radically different. Christ, 1860, for goodness sake, you know, William Barak, you know, Eastern Kulin leader, elder, you know, was trying to organize and protest and bring about justice. And, you know, we've had this lens in our history, even though I wasn't taught this stuff at school, we've had this, and that's what culture is. And that's how culture becomes this response to how we choose to organize ourselves as a society. So, yeah, I mean, it's a movement, you know, who cares if it's revolutionary or not? Culture is revolutionary. It's in a state of flux and change. And we get caught with our pants down, it seems, when we don't think of it in such a way. And that's what COVID, I feel, has just helped, sadly, tragically, force a huge number of people to suddenly think in such terms. So it's not just artists in art schools, you know, who are thinking such ways.
Just on COVID, because I'd be interested in getting your feedback on this as a Victorian. Look, we've got some big problems in Australia with old people's homes, for want of a better
word. That's awful. Yeah.
The Premier today said, you know, I wouldn't want that for my own parents to be in an old person's home. You know, some people just don't have a choice. So there's
it's awful. I know.
But, you know, that's what's happened out of COVID, you know, just making us, I don't know, rethink everything.
Yeah. Well, there's not enough money to go around. Yeah. I mean, that's what it gets down to. So it's always a contest, isn't it, as to what any level of government will how it will redistribute public resources. Now, of course, because it's political, all sorts of other things get in the way, ideologies and things that amount to nothing more than he said, she said. But hopefully this helps tease out leaders who are actually good leaders. Yeah, like we've suffered for so long with people that I find so difficult to even think of them as being a leader in the, you know, the way, you know, you would configure such a person, and the pettiness and the drivel and the and this is why there are so many people like my friend Paul Dunn who are working tirelessly and so hard, trying to bring about a sense of you know, evolution.
That's
for so many. Yeah, sorry.
That's a good segue, Les, because I want to talk about leaders and drivel, and talk about new programs that are taking on Adobe. And I know that you have a love-hate relationship with Photoshop, and Carmen and I were lucky enough to be given a version of Affinity Photo each to have a play with. Have you used Affinity Photo yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Since it was first born, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
And how do you see it as a good alternative to Photoshop for most people, or some people, if they want to get out of that whole Adobe sort of roundabout?
Well, there's two points there, isn't there? One is the subscription model of Adobe, and people being upset with that. Exactly. But then there's also the other issue of the incompetence of so much of Adobe, you know, how they go about doing this. Yeah. Now, I think affinity, I mean, I love affinity photo. I'm a huge fan of it, and I'm teaching workshops in it. It's in fact, this what's today? Thursday this week, I've got a workshop with four people on who are variously in Capture One and variously in Photoshop, and they want to move to affinity photo, and every one of them, I'm pretty sure, we'll find out in the introductions at the start of the workshop, but I'm pretty sure it's not because of the subscription model of Adobe. Now, there is how can I say this simply? Okay, here we go. One thing that Affinity has done really well. Now, don't get me wrong. I still think it's miles from where it should be, right? Yeah. But that's okay because we've got other software like 3D Look Creator that plays well with it.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's just because it's got shortcomings, it has made leaps and bounds ahead of Photoshop. I'll give you a simple idea.
Mm.
Now, when we process raw data, right?
Yeah.
One of the key priorities is white balance, black balance, gray balance. Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Taking off primary color cast so we can see what's there.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we use an RGB color model to do that because in an RGB color model, equal red, green, and blue is neutral. So it's really easy to neutralize white balance, tint, shadows, highlights. So that's the right and proper thing. Our raw processes deliver us an RGB file.
Hmm.
The problem is to then do a lot of things to our image, editing its tonal composition and its color composition, for example. If we stay working with RGB tools, right, and like curves, RGB curves, then we really have an incredibly hard time because an RGB model means that when you change one parameter, like the hue, the color of the color, you also change saturation and brightness of that color. You can't uncouple these things in an RGB model. That's part of the beauty of an RGB model. Hue, saturation, and brightness are locked together. Another problem, the way Photoshop elicits this process, of course, bears no relationship to everyday reality. When you darken an image in an RGB color model, such as, you know, pulling a Photoshop RGB curve down, you massively increase or variously increase saturation, which is not how our everyday common sense of the world sees the world. So it makes editing even more difficult. Now, Photoshop, to its credit, has other color models you can work in. CMYK, try doing that in Capture One. LAB, try doing that in Lightroom. You can get LAB readouts in Lightroom, but not LAB curves, for example.
Yeah.
And so we've got these other, they're scant. But the problem in Photoshop is that if I want to use an A channel curve, for example, I've got to convert my image into LAB. Guess what Affinity Photo does? It says, "Oh, Les, I see you've got an RGB image. Oh, it's encased within Adobe RGB brackets 1998. Okay, now, I see you've asked me to put a curve on there for you. So you've got some nodes that you can precisely locally edit values relative to one another. Now, what sort of a curve do you want? Do you want an L curve? What about an RGB curve that fucks everything up like in Photoshop? Or what about a cyan curve? Or what about a black curve from a CMYK profile that has 100% gray component replacement? No problem, Les. Here you go." So it's utterly brilliant like that. And all the blending modes are there and all the layers are there. It's got some weird little personas that you've got to understand the difference. But really, it's just another way of doing the same thing.
Yeah.
But I love it because they have understood and acknowledged the stupidness of Photoshop. And it's just grown up to be this mess upon a mess of gunk, right?
Yeah.
They still can't even open raw files. You've got to use a plugin to interpret raw data. Go figure. Yeah. So I love Affinity Photo. And I just don't, I teach Photoshop, but I don't use Photoshop. Haven't used it since Affinity Photo. There's one textbook on Affinity Photo. One textbook, you know, that's written by the bloody people who make the stuff. You know, I just love it.
Yeah.
So, and their design, application. I mean, I just love this stuff. It reminds me like the mid 1990s all over again, where we're starting to get this explosion of extraordinary applications that an affinity is, we've got Darktable, we've got all manner of applications out there. And of course, I can't leave home without it. 3D look creator as being the king and queen of this. Well, there you go, this revolution, if you like. Yeah. Really, it just feels like 1996, 1997 all over again. Extraordinary stuff. Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting. Well, I mean, I've had a bit of a play with Affinity, and there is a lot of crossovers, a lot of similarities, yes. Shortcuts and all that, and how it yes. kind of works. But there are some differences. So I might have to get on your workshop, Les, and get a bit of a brush up on how to do that. And so 3D Loot Creator, that actually works with it pretty well. This is similar to about how it does it in Photoshop.
Yeah, well, okay. The 3D Look Creator is directly hardwired to Photoshop. So a single click of a button will bring the Photoshop image into 3D Look Creator. Yep. Remember, though, 3D Look Creator, the world's greatest grading tool as far as I'm concerned, by a mile, by an absolute galaxy. Yep. 3D Look Creator edits our tonal and our color compositions. It doesn't edit our drawing composition.
Yeah.
You can't do a Peter Eastway and squish the mountain so it's a little steeper and a little scarier, right? You can't transform. It changed perspective. You can't spot. Yeah, you can't crop. Not really. You can't upscale or downscale. It edits our tonal composition and our color composition, two-thirds of our image. Yeah. So we still need a transforming program like Photoshop. Mm-hmm. And we still need a program, a compositing program that enables us to assemble various things, stacking images, for example. Mm. Now, traditionally, Photoshop, and certainly being the most ubiquitous, a single button in 3D Look Creator imports that image, yes, yeah. for then phenomenal playfulness in 3D Look Creator. Affinity Photo, it's only a right click away. Capture One, it's a right click, edit in. Yes, 3D Look Creator. So these things are only a right click away. Yeah. So it's almost as automatic as working with Photoshop.
Ah, good. Good to know.
Yeah. Yep. Seamless.
What about Lightroom? What about cataloging? How can we do that and get out of the Adobe architecture?
The catalog in Lightroom is pretty good, isn't it? If all you do is photographs and some video. Has real metadata problems with video, you probably discovered, Michael's discovered. So, yeah, cataloging is a real big one. Now, there are very expensive solutions out there, which are great. Let's not kid ourselves. But there's also a real gap. Like, we've got things like Photomechanic, which are incredible browsers, fast as can be. But databases are tricky. And on Mac and on PC, these things can be quite different. Now, we still use Canto Cumulus, even though it's, sort of built for museums and, huge business corporate, because it catalogs absolutely anything. I've got 30-year-old live picture files, and no problem at all. I'll recognize and catalog that ancient file format that the Library of Congress doesn't even understand anymore. So, I do make PDFs in InDesign, Illustrator. I've got all these different file types that I need to catalog. So I can't use Lightroom as much as I admire, certain aspects of its catalog database, library database. So we use we've been using Cumulus for 30 years, so everything is built up around that. But there are a range, and they're pretty cheap, like $150, and there are tools out there. But it really depends on where you're coming from and what the platform is that you're trying to work to.
Yeah, So, Liz, so you've got all your online courses now coming up, and you do quite a few of them. So people can just zip over to your website to find out what's coming up. And is there any limits on how many people can get on these things? Or
No, we're still limited to 5 people. Yeah.
Okay.
Occasionally, because you know, it's a kind of a just send me an email booking system, I've ended up with 6 people on a couple of occasions, you know, like a couple, you know, sign up. So there's 2 people. And of course, because it's virtual, it's not that I have run out of chairs around our table, which was the physical limit.
Yeah.
But there's still
interaction side of it.
Yeah. You've still got to be able to give people enough individual attention. Like the 3 we're going to get together shortly, and I think there are 5 people in that course, but it's I mean, that's what we try and aim for. So as long as there's 3 people, we financially work. We go to 5 people, mainly 5 people is what we get.
Well, look, as always, Les, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I can sit and listen to you all day, but unfortunately I've got bloody emails to do now. I'm going to take away all the things that you talked about in regards to, you know, creating work and your mindset and all that sort of stuff. And I do have an idea coming up, and I'll share that with you later on sometime and see what you think. But I guess it's, you know, you've just got to be true to yourself and what you believe and how you work and not be so hard on yourself, I guess, at times, because we all tend to look at other people's work at times and go, oh, I wish I had taken that photograph, or I wish I had that idea, or, you know, why couldn't I have done that? Or, you know, so, you know, it's always good to get a bit of clarity from you. And, thank you for being you. I'll keep hassling you to write that book one day. Because it would be so good to have an encyclopedia of all your knowledge, mate. We just need that.
Don't forget, under the words tab on our website, there's a couple of 100,000 words there already, Fletch.
Yeah, I know. It'd be good to have it in a book, though, with your images. And
okay. Les, well, this is a direct question.
What's that?
When are we going to see a book from Dr. Les Walkling?
Yeah, no, I don't think I will ever write a book. I'm too close to my musician friends and the idea of performance.
Yeah,
you know, I know they put their CDs out, right, as a fixed sort of thing. Well, I still write stuff and publish it. Books cost money, you know. Even e-books cost a lot of money. I just prefer to write on specific topics, and just make it available through the workshops, and you know, and to me, that's where I get it back to me. Yeah. It's like, how can I say this? It's like I'm playing a keyboard or something, you know, and you're improvising. Whereas when you try and compartmentalize things in, like I used to have these huge bodies of stuff that would go on a CD with every workshop I did. Oh, here's the digital print. Here's 100 pages of blah, blah, blah. And I would package them like a book, you know. This is a long time ago now, but that's how we used to do it. And I very quickly realized that that was as boring as all hell for me, and it wasn't that helpful, because people still had to wade through that to find what was of importance to them. Whereas what I do now, and which I've done for, I don't know, 20 years, whatever it is now, is, of course, after we finished our workshop, like even after the Daintree get together last Sunday, you know, I then put together a resource website with those actions and those notes and that video and a few other things, which we then sent out to everyone. That was in direct response to the questions and the images and the things that we looked at as a result of that. And that to me is really interesting, and that and that's how I like to do it. Whereas and yet, you know, I live and die by my physical libraries. I just don't think that's just not me, you know.
Fair enough. Yeah. That's a good,
but it's
that's a
very kind of you to ask. The it's the software I couldn't think of just before for Macs is the old CD Finder software. I think it's now called Neo Finder. I think Neo Finder, one word, maybe two words. That is
cataloging.
That is a really, if I wasn't using Cumulus, I would probably be looking at that. Yeah. And, but there's a really cheap version, but it's the enterprise version or business version. I can't quite remember what it's called. That is the, is really fully featured, you know, enables you to do all sorts of level database searching and so forth. And that's, it's pretty cool. And that catalogs from memory, everything. Fantastic.
Well, Les, thanks, mate, for your time.
No worries, mate.
Busy man. It's great to talk to you. We will tune in again soon. Love to get you back on because, you know, we've got about a million episodes with just you. We could easily fill out the rest of our podcast with you talking. So we'd love it. And our listeners love it as well. So, all right, mate, you take it easy. Stay safe over there. And I will catch you online very soon because I'm going to just about to book into your 3D LUT creator workshop. So,
yeah, I've already got you on the list, Fletch.
Oh, have you?
You're on the top of the list. Yep.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. All right. Well, I better go pay my money.
Oh, no, that's okay. We'll plenty of time for that. Don't you worry. Yeah. Now, but look, thank you, Fletch, and thank you, Carwin, for having me on. Hopefully, there's been something there for someone. And if so, I will sleep well tonight. If not, I won't sleep well tonight. But you'll be kind enough to give me another go to redeem myself at another time. I would hope. Yeah,
I'm gonna sleep like a baby tonight, mate.
All right, you take care, guys.
Dr. Les Walkland, thanks for joining us on Light Minded. Thank you.
No, it's an absolute pleasure.